I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Apartments in Kansas City are going up faster now than since before the Great Recession, and a lot of them are in walkable urban areas that for years have lagged in residential development. Today, find out why the apartment boom is happening now, who's moving in, and what else is needed downtown to ensure that residents and the new neighborhoods are healthy and happy. Then, state-level Democrats across the country were dealt a blow at the ballot box last November, Missouri included. So where do they go from here? I'll speak with the chair of the Missouri Democratic Party, who will share his game plan for recovery and possible redemption. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. A recent report by Colliers says that the Kansas City area will see a 22% increase in the number of new apartments completed this year over last, and the bulk of them will be in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. So why the increase? Who's looking to move in? And how much bang are they getting for their buck? Here with some answers are Kevin Collison. He covers development in the metro, and his article on the apartment boom can be found at kcur.org. Kevin, always good to have you here.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Christina Boveri is owner of Boveri Realty Group that specializes in downtown residential listings. Christina, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Michael Frisch is an associate professor and program director of urban planning and design at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Kevin, when Colliers said a 22% increase, tell us about that. How many new units are we talking about here?
Well, Colliers International put out a study for the first quarter of this year, and they project that by the end of this year, there'll be at least 5,000 new apartment units coming online here in Kansas City.
And citywide?
Metro-wide, I
metro-wide.
Should say. Yes, yes.
That's a lot of apartments.
It is a lot of apartments. Apparently, it's the largest number since the Great Depression, recession of 2008, and it contrasts with what had been an annual average of about 1,800 units annually. And what we're hearing from people is that the big driver of this and the big location where many of these are going up is in downtown Kansas City and also, interestingly, Old Overland Park.
And the
combining element there is that there is a real desire by both millennials and empty nesters to be in a more walkable environment where they can basically just live without having to drive miles to get to basic services.
Yeah, I'm wondering, are most of these new units, Kev, in new buildings or in structures that have been remodeled for residential use?
It's actually a combination of the two. And what's really interesting is, for many years, many of the apartments being developed, particularly in downtown, were in renovated historic buildings. We're almost now at the end of that inventory of older office buildings that were obsolete that could be converted. So we're actually seeing a lot of new construction as well.
And that's the big change, right?
That is a significant change.
Christina Boveri, is this a case of build it and they will come, or have you been seeing a demand that wasn't being met out there?
Well, build it and hopefully they will come for 4,000 or 5,000 units. We've not had this influx of units ever.
Are you worried that this is too much too fast?
Everyone tends to jump on board, and then it will be the biggest increase or influx we've ever had. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. And so before the demand was there, we were actually turning people away, literally turning people away to, Overland Park, North Kansas City, because we really didn't have anything. And so we started building and we continued building. Of course, between 04 to 08, I'd say 05 to 08 was condominiums. And then, of course, the recession, the people still wanted to live downtown. They started building apartments because we couldn't build condominiums because of the lending. The banks wouldn't lend on new condominiums. So yes, it's the demand is definitely there. Our occupancy levels a couple years ago were hovering at 98%, 99%.
Wow.
We are still in the 90 percentile, but this influx, they're all rolling out in the next 2 years. So hopefully we would be able to fill them all.
Let me get our listeners to chime in here. If you're an apartment dweller in one of our city's downtowns, what do you like about it and what's missing? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888 is our number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Professor Frisch, you sort of wonder here, is this a trend or is this something that's going to be long lasting?
So it's definitely a trend. It's something that's been seen in other downtowns across the country. In some ways, Kansas City is late in terms of having this happen. It's also connected to demography, that millennials are the baby boomlet, and the two markets for downtown living are the baby boomers who are now empty nesters, and then their kids who might have doubled up during the recession and are now looking to form households.
Oh, that's interesting. When it comes to urban planning, what does it mean to a city to have people living in its center rather than commuters who are only there for work from 9 to 5, as was the case in downtown Kansas City for so many years?
So this means we can double up on the services that are downtown. So a parking lot that used to just service offices now can do double duty and service the people living there at night. And remember that a lot of the jobs in our region are now out along the Beltway.
Yeah.
So there's a reverse commute going on.
You know, Kevin, in researching your article, what are people looking for in apartment living, whether it's downtown Kansas City or downtown Overland Park, where, as you've mentioned, a similar boom is happening? Is it this walkable community thing that you were just talking about?
Very much so. I mean, you know, a lot of these folks, in the case of baby boomers, they don't want to mess around with taking care of a yard or all the rest of the work associated with a household.
Boy, can I relate
to
that,
you and me
as
both.
Someone who's got to mow some grass on a 90-degree weekend.
Right, right. Yeah. And younger people are very influenced by the growing popularity throughout the United States of that more urban living and not having to be tied to a car. And Kansas City actually, you know, as Mike said, is late to the game. I've had developers tell me that they've seen activity like this going on in Indy and Cincinnati, et cetera, et cetera. But we've done a good job, I think, in the sense that we've gotten a terrific grocery store downtown. We were one of the pioneers as far as downtowns of our size to have something like Cosentino's open up in the Power and Light District, and there's just a new grocery store that just opened up in the River Market. And the streetcar helps people get back and forth.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, people like that urban lifestyle where they don't have to mess around with all the exterior obligations of owning a house. They can just go downstairs, go out, meet some friends, walk up to the Power and Light, go see a movie at the Alamo, shop for their groceries at Cosentino or the City Market, and then hop on the streetcar to get back and forth. So it's just a kind of a more hip environment, and we're seeing it around the country.
Professor Frisch, what makes for a walkable neighborhood these days? What are we talking about here? What constitutes that?
So Kevin hit on it. It really is the grocery store. It's the restaurant. It's the third space, the place where you can go to live that's not inside your own apartment. It's so you hang out, spaces to hang out in. So the Kauffman Center really helps, but it's coffee shops, restaurants, places to browse,
that's
art
because
galleries.
What the apartments tend to be kind of small.
Yeah.
So people want to go somewhere else, too.
So it means that places that are – so it's like your local tavern may be coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we see that in terms of commercial development in the Crossroads.
That's interesting. Now, Christina, in the apartments your firm has listed lately, what percentage would you say are in true walkable neighborhoods where residents literally can come out of their building and easily walk to an essential service like a grocery store?
85% to 90%.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're there.
Yeah, and the biggest areas that are walkable right now is, you know, of course, the River Market area, the Crossroads Art District. I mean, the dots are being connected. And the Loop is also definitely attractive. And besides, you know, just the amenities they're drawn to, people are drawn to the diversity of downtown. The lock and leave lifestyle is very attractive for people. And the baby boomers are now coming down because we have those amenities. I mean, we're still lacking retail, and of course, in order to have retail, you need more people to support it. So it's, you know, catch 22. But as we're connecting those dots north and south, we're starting to see the development starting to go to the east and to the west.
And Steve, I might add that the downtown council estimates that at this point right now, there's 25 to 30,000 people living in what they call greater downtown, which is everything from the riverfront out to Crown Center and 31st Street.
That was sort of the goal that Kay Barnes set for the downtown.
She certainly helped prime the pump.
Kay
Barnes was extremely influential in A, encouraging housing downtown, and B, making downtown a more attractive place for people to live. Because as you and I know, and 15, 20 years ago, downtown was a pretty desolate place.
Yeah. We have a full board of calls here, so if you want to try option two, at KCUR, up to date is where you can tweet us. Our phone number again, 816-235-2888. Doug from downtown Kansas City, Missouri. Doug, what's missing down there? Anything?
Yeah, so I'm a condo owner downtown, so one thing I think is more condos, so not just rental where people can fly in and fly out. I kind of feel more people would actually like to have that option of actually owning downtown. Second thing I would think is a little bit missing is I think a lot of us talk about downtown as Target, so a retail store like that. So we would love to live, work, shop, and play downtown, and I think those types of things is what's missing. I just saw a neat one in Chicago when my family was up there that we really liked, and hopefully one day we can replicate that downtown.
So your point is, Doug, that Targets do occupy spaces in downtown parts of our cities around the country.
Yeah, I was just in Chicago. It's a beautiful urban space, walkable, double stories. Had things, that didn't take up a large footprint like a Target in the suburbs.
Right.
So very much tailored for that. We'd love to see something like that in KC. But we've lived there for 2 years, and we absolutely love it. You couldn't pry us down. But that is one thing that's missing is more ownership opportunities and things like that in retail.
Sounds good, Doug. Thanks for the good call. If you're just joining us here, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about the Kansas City, Missouri apartment boom here. Again, the number 816-235-2888. Martha from Old Overland Park writes, would like to see a grocer in the downtown area out there. You know of any in sight?
Oh, well, they've got the farmer's market on Saturdays in Old Overland Park.
I think she wants something
more than that. I don't know if there is a grocery store within walking distance if you're living in an apartment in or around downtown Overland Park. I don't know.
But there's one needed, it sounds like. Professor Frisch, this notion that our caller just raised about condos owning your unit versus an apartment that you pay month-to-month rent for, what's the trend there, and why is the push more towards the apartment end in Kansas City more than the condo end?
So, I think you ought to talk to our other guest about that.
Yeah, go. Yeah, Christina.
We have not built any for sale condominiums or buildings since the recession. So there is very little inventory for sale. One area, and I agree. The developers are using the tax incentives to build these apartment buildings, which they have to keep rental for 5 years before they can flip those over.
So that's part of the rules for getting the tax incentive?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so to find a lender that will finance a condominium building is still very difficult. So the home ownership is definitely in high demand downtown. The inventory is very low. And one thing we're really lacking that people would like to see is, and I know we don't have a lot of land, but is, single family homes or some really cool little townhomes. I mean, we're not talking we need big, big homes. And that's why you see this burst of development on Troost. Columbus Park is going to be a complete different picture in the next, 5-10 years. West Side, you can't even find a house on the West Side. So people are looking for home ownership that is proximity to the amenities of downtown.
Okay. Let's go back to some calls here. Let's go to Carol from the Plaza area. Carol, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Okay. I've been following city planning and development, and I have some concern about chasing the lending and everybody building high-end luxury housing, which is causing us to lose our variety and our affordable housing. And I'm concerned about a planning aspect that we're losing important aspects of our city.
Kevin, well, is there a lack of affordable housing?
There is
in
definitely
all
a lack of affordable rents. I'm talking about apartments. But for a long time, getting back to Kay Barnes, at that period of time, the state allowed people to layer together state historic preservation taxes as well as affordable housing taxes or tax credits. And you had a significant number of affordable units built downtown. But then the powers that be in Jeff City decided you can't layer those things anymore, and so we've seen a significant cutback in the amount. Now, the city is trying to be a little more proactive. There was a project the other day that I covered at the Planned Industrial Expansion Authority in which they're demanding that the developer set aside a certain number or a certain percentage of his units for affordable housing. You see that a lot in other major urban areas like Seattle and San Francisco, and where they basically say, look, we will help you with some incentives, but you've got to reserve a certain number of those units as affordable.
But we're not doing that yet here, you're saying.
Well, we're doing it, but not nearly as robustly as we were 10 years ago. And I think part of that is the problem that they've made these affordable housing tax credits more difficult to use for developers.
Michael, how big of a concern is all this?
So Kansas City has a surplus of housing. We have vacant houses in Kansas City. So the problem is,
particularly on the east side.
Yeah. And so the problem really is the quality of the unit and the location of the unit. So if you're already in, if you're paying low rent in a high demand area, there's very little protection for you. When your lease is up, the owner has the right to raise the rent, and you go back into negotiation at that point. Mm-hmm. So the problem there is that some folks are going to get displaced because they're not going to be able to afford these newer, higher rents for these prime locations. However, there are other places in the city where the rents aren't as high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kev.
Well, one quick thing. One of the interesting trends, and I think Christina can probably attest to this, is like the Pickwick Building is about to open up as apartments, and they have deliberately gone to a very relatively small unit. It's not the kind of place that you and I would want to live in, but for a young person in their 20s who really getting back to wanting to be out and about and really doesn't need a lot of space to live in, and the rents correspondingly are much lower. So they're creating small units and keeping the rents down in order to make it more affordable to young people. But again, it's not the kind of product that you and I would want after living in a house for many years.
Christina, I was wondering if we can just talk for a minute about what money can get you when it comes to apartments in downtown Kansas City. What's the metro average rent for an apartment? Do you have that figure?
Well, if I was to take all of the buildings and apartments and put them in
One pod.
We'd probably be averaging about $1.75 a square foot. So 1,000 square feet, you're going to be paying $1,700 a month. All of the new construction units, whether it's one light, two light, anything that's new construction, or even a historical complete gut job that's brand new, you're going to be looking at, you know, really around $2 a foot when you add parking, and that's expensive.
How does that compare to other cities, Kev?
Compared to other cities, I think we're still lower. But I was just going to say, 5 years ago, when I was still reporting at the Star, developers were hoping they could get to $1.50 square foot level, and so this has been a significant bump over the past few years.
I've also read the average metro rent is about $900 a month, something like that, the average number. What can that get me in the heart of Kansas City? Anything?
$900. Tell me where you're going.
Downtown, no, right?
Yeah,
downtown.
Even $900 is very difficult to find.
Yeah, that's what the Pickwick
average rent. If you put them all together, also you're going to be looking at about $1,300 to $1,400 for an average rent, and that's a one bedroom. That's a one bedroom apartment.
How about two bedroom, two bath?
Two bedrooms, you're looking at anywhere from $1,500 to $2,200.
Boy, that's amazing. Boy, times have changed in Kansas City.
Try to find anything in Chicago, though, for $15 to $20.
Oh, that's right.
Talk with New York.
Al from downtown Kansas City, you're on the air, Al.
Okay, first of all, I have to say this. We're not Chicago. We're not New York. Thank God for that.
Yeah.
But my comment, is that stacked housing. I live downtown, and stacked housing, and I'm originally an East Coaster who grew up in stacked housing in apartments, and stacked housing makes people more civilized, more responsive to their community, a little hello in the elevator, a sense of neighborhood. It's a very healthy thing for Kansas City, and at least this is my experience after 30 years here, is that we are growing in other ways which are cultural as well. excuse me, and living in these in apartments in Kansas City is a new experience for a lot of our community, and it's teaching us how to be kinder to each other and more civilized, and
that's
not so isolated in our little suburban isolation booths.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to share that. I think it's a big deal, and I think culturally it's a big addition. Just as the arts are, I think the way this stacked living model for Kansas City is going to be a cultural plus.
That's interesting. Elle, thanks for the good call. I appreciate it. Let me go to Barbara from Midtown. Barbara, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the apartment boom in Kansas City, Missouri.
Well, my main issue is the, once again, an almost mass redistribution of wealth to the top. I mean, so many people who are elderly and poor are being displaced. They can't. You talked to this issue before, but you know, it just seems to me it ought to be incumbent of, upon a person wanting to move to Midtown to be able to live with greater economic diversity as well as racial diversity.
Hmm.
And my experience living here in Midtown in one of the older buildings. And I live only on Social Security, so I will not be able to live here much longer, probably. I don't have transportation to move far out, and everybody's white that's moving in. I'm used to a much more mixed neighborhood.
Yeah.
And where are these people going to go? All the amenities for the poor, are like Truman Hospital and so on, are here. Are you going to? Can we move to the suburbs? You know, the suburbs is not an option. They don't want us.
Right. Barbara, I'm really glad you called. This notion of gentrification, Michael or Kevin, and for folks being forced out of their buildings because more well-to-do folks are moving in. What are we seeing?
It's interesting to hear this woman speak about Midtown. I mean, I actually had not heard a lot about gentrification here in town. I mean, most of the stuff downtown is new. I mean, there weren't people that are being booted out. They may not be able to afford to live there, but they weren't being displaced. But she raises a big, big issue. And again, I'm glad she brought it up.
Okay. I've heard of cases in Midtown of exactly this, of older apartment buildings being renovated. The answer is to provide. We've got to start providing low-income housing. And we've got to have
a
housing
plan. As part of this mix, yeah.
Yeah, we've got to start planning for that because mm-hmm. there are our folks who need to be close to services.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, mass transit's a big part of this. And we now have Ride KC, that's this on-call transportation service. That can help people age in place and maybe it can meet the needs of folks a little bit farther out.
Right. Is this city guilty of rushing to satisfy this apartment boom and overlooking the needs of low-income folks?
Absolutely. I think, I love to see the growth, and I'm an optimist, but, you know, we definitely need, like Kevin was saying earlier, what we were offering, back in the day, I think if we're going to give these incentives, I think we should make percentage of these buildings
mm-hmm.
Lower income, so we have that diversity. We absolutely need it.
I'm surprised that wasn't part of the deal to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, again, you know, we went from 0 to 60. You know, a lot of this early on was just like trying to get life back into downtown, and now definitely we're in a maturer market. People want to live downtown, and we're in a position, we meaning city and public policy officials, to say, okay, look, let's make sure we have affordable as an option.
Let's go to Larry from Strawberry Hill over in Kansas City, Kansas. Larry, thanks for calling.
Hi. I'd like to just echo the sentiments about gentrification happening both downtown and throughout Midtown. It seems like the statement that there was no life downtown or in Midtown is pretty false. There was life there, and it was a grassroots use of the spaces there, but. Then you had developers like Mac Properties and Cordish come through and basically stop the development that was happening from within Kansas City and just make it a place for rich white people.
Kevin, respond to that.
Well, I disagree with this gentleman. Mac Properties, in my mind, did a heroic job reviving Armor Boulevard between Troost and Main Street. Those buildings were falling apart. There was an incredible crime problem in that area. Now it's a really, really nice area for young people to live. I'm not saying that there's not issues with gentrification, particularly in Midtown. But again, you get back to downtown, and I defy anybody to say that it was a lively place 15 or 20 years ago. Westport, Midtown, I'm not arguing with that at all. It's a great area, and it is a concern. But I would never slam Mac Properties for what they did on Armour Boulevard.
We'll have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank our good guest for this very interesting conversation about a big change in our town, Kevin Collison, who follows and writes about development in the greater Kansas City area. Kevin, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Christina Boveri, owner of Boveri Realty Group. Christina, thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Frisch is an associate professor and program director of urban planning and design at UMKC. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll meet the man who's taking on the redevelopment and refurbishment, if you will, of the Democratic Party in Missouri. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, the ethics professors discussed my suggestion to rename the J.C. Nichols Memorial Fountain and whether a teacher should be able to flip off the White House and post it to Facebook. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate or go to the NPR1 app. On Monday, psychologist Wes Crenshaw shares advice for helping teens cope with anxiety. He says stress on young people is higher than he's ever seen it. That's Monday on the show. Well, Stephen Weber is a 34-year-old former Missouri state representative who's spending some of the most important years of his career trying to resurrect a political party. In this case, it's the Missouri Democratic Party, a party that held a bunch of statewide offices until last November's election. Boosted by Donald Trump's 19-point win in the state, the GOP swept races for governor, attorney general, state treasurer, and secretary of state. The party won the U.S. Senate seat on the ballot and raced to huge wins in the General Assembly. Shortly after that election, Weber was elected the new chairman of the Missouri Democratic State Committee. He was available for the job, by the way, because he lost his own race for a Columbia State Senate seat last fall. Stephen Weber joins us now, and Stephen, welcome.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from the studios of St. Louis Public Radio is political reporter Jason Rosenbaum. Jason, nice to have you.
Good to be back, Steve.
Stephen, you're 34 years old. Why did you want to spend your life trying to resurrect a fading political party?
Well, I believe in the things that we're doing. The Republican Party now controls the state of Missouri. They control Washington, D.C. In the last 6 months, we've seen them threaten to throw 22 million people off health insurance to gut coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. This week, 60,000 Missouri seniors lost assistance for prescription drug medication. We've seen them gut employment discrimination protections. We've seen them cut funding to higher education. And these things matter. These things are important. And it's important for me. And it's important for the Democratic Party to push back against these cuts and against what the Republicans are trying to do to Missouri and to this country.
The key to turning this thing around is what?
Organizing.
And that means what?
So we put together a plan, and we're focusing on the Missouri Democratic Party. We're focusing on three things: recruiting and training candidates for the state legislature, communicating the Democratic message, and rebuilding Democratic clubs, rural clubs, young Democrats, college Democrats, Democratic organizations like that across the state. Those are the three things that we're going to do to be successful as a state party.
Jason, what do you think that state Democrats can do to salvage what's left over from last November, or would it be easier just to start over from scratch?
I think a lot of it is going to depend on the national environment next year. If Donald Trump's approval ratings in Missouri are very low, then I think the Democrats have an opportunity to defend what they have, which is getting U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill reelected,
right,
and then Nicole Galloway elected to a full term, and possibly gain ground in the General Assembly. A lot of these elections tend to correspond with the national environment. But Stephen's right. Like, the Democratic Party in the state needs kind of a full overhaul when it comes to organizing the local efforts. I know that Stephen has traveled all over the state and is asking a lot of local Democrats what they need in the state party. I was in Northeast Missouri a few weeks ago and saw just how challenging it's going to be to gain ground back, even in traditionally Democratic areas of outstate Missouri. And it's critical. Like, Claire McCaskill is not going to get reelected if she's getting 20 and 30% of the votes in outstate Missouri. She needs to do what she did in 2006, where she got 40 and 45%, or in 2012, where she actually won a bunch of rural counties due to Todd Akin's implosion.
Jason, when you say you were in Northeast Missouri and you saw firsthand the challenges ahead for folks like Stephen Weber, what do you mean? Explain that to us. What did you see?
When Stephen was in the Missouri House, a majority of the Northeast Missouri delegation was Democratic. And not only now is that no longer the case, there's not even a single Democrat that represents Northeast Missouri in the legislature. And on the local level, where the Democratic Party has dominated county offices for decades, if not centuries, you're seeing Republicans start to take over county commission seats and county-wide offices, which is, I think, problematic for the Democratic Party long-term in outstate Missouri, because sometimes people from the county level are the people you find to run for state legislative seats. So that's why I think you've heard from Stephen this emphasis on improving the local organizations all over the state to get that infrastructure done, not only to help Claire McCaskill and Nicole Galloway, but also to kind of provide a better foundation for Democrats right. to bounce back in places which they've held for generations.
You know, Stephen Weber, the party, the Democratic Party, has basically two strongholds in this very big state, Kansas City and St. Louis. And the rest of the state is bright red. And you can see that every November when you look at the results of these elections. What's your assessment? Why has outstate Missouri turned its back on your party?
So one of the most fascinating things is the map, if you look at from the 1988 election. In 1988, J. Nixon ran for the United States Senate, and he didn't win a single county in Missouri. He won St. Louis City, and that was it. It was a bright red map. And in 1989, if you were betting on how Democrats were going to do in the next election, you would say they've probably lost outstate Missouri. Well, in 1992, Mel Carnahan ran for governor, and he carried, if you look at the map there, it looks, just eyeballing it, about like two-thirds blue. That Mel Carnahan came back and won counties that J. Nixon had gotten 28-30% of
right.
Before that. And you know, J. Nixon was a young candidate and went on to win many statewide elections. But you need to have candidates that connect and can understand people in rural communities. And one of the things that we're very fortunate to have, and I went through at the beginning the list of things that we've lost, and there's plenty of those. But at the top of our ticket, Senator Claire McCaskill is someone who's got a unique ability to connect with Missourians from all over the state, that understands the state, that has won Missouri in years like 2002 that were difficult years. Mm-hmm. I think Jason's right. The national mood has a tremendous impact. But what we've seen is people like Jason Kander, people even like Chris Koster, who well overperformed the top of the ticket, who were able to buck the national trend, not buck it enough in 2016, but still drastically overperform the generic ballot said they should have done. People like Senator McCaskill, who have won in years. 2002 was a very difficult year for Democrats in Missouri, but she managed to win that. And so we have to show up in those places. We have to compete everywhere. We have to organize. We have to show that we care about every single community, whether it's an urban community, whether it's a rural community. We have to compete for every single vote.
You know, Stephen, President Trump carried Missouri, as I mentioned in the opening, by 19 points in November. What if it had still been a landslide and he had won by 10? How would the lineup be different today? I mean, would Chris Koster be governor? Would Jason Kander be in the U.S. Senate? Is there almost a mathematical way to break down these numbers and give you a sense of what might have been?
I don't think it's as scientific as saying there's a mathematical way, but there's no doubt that when Jason Kander overperforms the top of the ticket by 16 points, that if it had just been a 10-point loss, if it had been 2012, it had been 2008, he would have been elected. Probably same with Chris Koster. But you know, I don't want to spend too much time focusing on 2016.
Sure.
2016 is over. 2016 happened. What we need to figure out is how is the Democratic Party going to rebuild to be successful in 2018? How are we going to make forward progress? How are we going to make gains in the legislature? And how are we going to put ourselves in position to be successful in 2020 and in the long run? That's what I really am focused on as chair of the party.
Well, let's do that. Let's go with that, Jason Rosenbaum, and go back to this notion of what's happened to outstate Missouri when it comes to the standing of the Missouri Democratic Party. Jason, does it come down to these age-old social issues like guns and abortion? Is that what we're talking about here?
I think that's part of it, and I think that one of the issues that Democratic Party leaders in Missouri have to deal with is that a lot of voters who feel very strongly opposed to abortion rights and are opposed to gun control associate any Democratic candidate with the National Party, even if they're also opposed to abortion rights and gun control. On the other hand, like, there have been candidates who are proponents of abortion rights and support some gun control that have been very successful in rural Missouri. Senator McCaskill is one of them, and Jay Nixon, to some extent, was one of them, maybe because they sense an authenticity that rural voters aren't being pandered to just because they believe in those issues and they're willing to respect that difference of opinion. But I think the economy does play a big role here. From some people that I talked to, kind of on both the Republican and Democratic side of the fence, they've seen the economic decline of rural Missouri for a long time. And some of these places, you know, the leadership was part of the Democratic Party, either on a local level or a governor level. And they're putting their faith in these Republican leaders to turn things around. Now, conversely, if people like Eric Greitens and Donald Trump don't actually deliver economic opportunity to places like Northeast Missouri and the Boot Heel and Central Missouri, then I think that's the opportunity there that you can get the voters back to the Democratic side by pointing to, you know, these Republicans promised economic prosperity and they didn't deliver.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the future of the Missouri Democratic Party. We're joined by the state chairman, Stephen Weber, and Jason Rosenbaum, who's a political reporter from St. Louis Public Radio, a veteran in the state house for many years. This idea, Stephen, let's talk about Governor Greitens, this new breed of Republican who's now the top elected official in Missouri. What's your sense? How's he doing?
Well, when you say new breed, he really is new because he was at the DNC with Governor Bob Holden when Barack Obama accepted the Democratic nomination because he was a Democrat for most of his adult life, and I think for opportunity's sake became a Republican. So he, when you say new breed of Republican, Governor Greitens is a new Republican. You know, he is somebody that has shown no interest in learning how government works. He doesn't seem to have much interest in the policy outcomes. You know, 60,000 low-income Missouri seniors lost prescription drug assistance this week. Earlier this week, he gutted employment discrimination protections, and he's done very little to try to figure out how he can alleviate these problems. I think what Jason said was right. Like, there have been fights over social issues since the 1970s, since the 1980s. Jerry Litton's U.S. Senate primary, Harriet Wood's lieutenant governor race, U.S. Senate race in the 80s. I think what a lot of these elections, you know, and the Democratic Party has been successful in rural. We've both won and lost races in rural communities with candidates that are pro-choice and candidates that are pro-life. But I think it's going to come down to is can the Republican supermajorities in the legislature, can the governor, the president, deliver the economic change that they promised? And so far, what they've done is they've made it more difficult for seniors to buy prescription coverage. They're trying to drain money out of public schools, which are the beating heart of rural communities. They're the biggest employer in most rural towns.
Well, they would argue that the school funding is at the highest level it's ever been.
Well, they've been draining for years. They've been draining. They're trying to get money to out of public schools and into private schools. They're doing it in Jefferson City. They're doing that in Washington, D.C. That's what their education plan is right now. And that idea of school choice doesn't help somebody in a rural county of 6,000 people because there's not multiple schools. So they're not doing anything to actually improve voters' lives. And Stephen, that's what this election is going to come down to.
Do you have any sense of what Governor Greitens' job approval rating is in Missouri right now? Has your party polled, or have you seen polls that would indicate that?
We haven't polled. I will say that I have not met a single person that feels better about Governor Greitens now than they did before the election. I know a lot of people that supported him that are stunned by his unethical behavior, just the constant ethics problems he has. Mm-hmm. They're stunned by the fact that he's throwing thousands of Missourians off prescription drug assistance, and he's spending all his time with Donald Trump in Washington, D.C., or with the Koch brothers. And people he promised this new type of leadership, and he has utterly failed to deliver on that. So there's just from interacting with people, there's nobody that likes him now and he underperformed Donald Trump by a pretty significant margin here in Missouri. There's nobody that's moving to his side, and there's a lot of people that regret having voted for him.
Jason Rosenbaum, as you cover this state and look at the politics of it, do you have a sense of how well Governor Greitens is being received now that he's navigated his first full legislative session?
Well, it's pretty clear that, you know, a lot of elected officials from both parties have found fault in a lot of what he's done. But frankly, like, he didn't win election as governor by making political people happy. He won election because he was able to get 6% more of the vote than Chris Koster. And I think one of the challenges for Democrats going into 2020, assuming that he runs for reelection, is first of all, they need a strong candidate to run against him. And I think that's one of the reasons why there might be a big emphasis on Nicole Galloway getting elected, because I think that she's widely seen as a future gubernatorial candidate or possibly U.S. Senate candidate.
She's
down
the state
road.
Auditor today.
State yeah. auditor. Mm-hmm. And they need a bench of people to not only run for governor, but run for these other offices. But the other thing is, having covered Governor Greitens at rallies and talked with him personally and seen how he's interacted with people, he has been able to, I think, bring a lot of people that are not interested in politics kind of to get excited about his candidacy, at least last year. I guess it remains to be seen whether he can maintain that momentum as he governs and makes decisions that make people unhappy. But for the Democrats to successfully combat him, they need candidates. They need to kind of cut into what I feel is a really genuine connection between the governor and ordinary people.
I would disagree with that. He underperformed the top of the ticket by 12 points. Right. He became the governor because Donald Trump won by 19 points in Missouri. He did significantly worse than the top of his party's presidential ticket. And since then, we've seen bipartisan calls. I mean, Jason alluded to that. Republicans have called for him to be investigated for his ethics problems.
Well, but to Jason's point, though, you look at future elections, you see the Republican Party has a deep bench by virtue of their wins last November. I mean, who's your next candidate for governor? Who are your next candidates for U.S. Senate?
Had anybody thought that Eric Greitens was going to be governor in 2013 or Donald Trump was going to be president?
That's a fair point.
I mean, everybody in the Democratic Party had better be focused on winning elections in 2018.
You know, Stephen, one thing I'm wondering is how you grow the party, and I'm wondering if there's room in the Missouri Democratic Party for anti-abortion Democrats, because that's become an issue that the Democratic Party in Kansas is facing right now with one of its candidates for governor who's running as a pro-life candidate. Is there room in your party for anti-abortion Democrats?
We talked about that sort of under the idea of reaching out and particularly rural communities. I mean, that's been an issue in the Missouri Democratic Party literally since the 1970s.
That's right.
I was reading about Jerry Litton's U.S. Senate primary, and that was an issue in his Senate primary back in the 70s. When I came into the legislature, there were a lot of rural Democrats. Some of them, like Rebecca McClanahan, were pro-choice, and some, like Rachel Bringer, had strongly held convictions on being pro-life. And the party was better having Democrats throughout Northeast Missouri. And there's room for people, as long as they work hard and they're willing to stand in front of a room and say with conviction why they believe, then there's room for you in the Missouri Democratic Party.
So the answer is yes.
Okay.
The Associated Press also just had an interesting story, Stephen, about the lack of major party candidates in so many House races in the state. The AP said that last fall, this is interesting, 60% of Missouri House races, there's 163 seats in the House, 60% lacked a Republican or Democratic candidate. That ranked in the top tier of states nationally. I mean, 60%. Why aren't the two parties competing in more races? Why isn't your party have a candidate for all 163 slots here?
So there's two issues there. The first issue is that because of the way the lines are drawn, they become so partisan that both sides are leaving a lot of seats uncontested. And that's a problem for democracy across the board, both throughout Missouri and around the whole country. The second issue, which is why in 2006, out of 163 House seats, there were 140 Democrats that ran. And then last cycle, out of 163 House seats, there were 97. That's an issue that the Democratic Party needs to fix. And so when I talked about our plan, what I said was the first thing, our number one priority is recruiting and training candidates. Mm-hmm. That is the single most important job the Missouri Democratic Party has over the next year until filing closes.
Jason Rosenbaum, what's your explanation for that? Why are so many seats going uncontested here?
I think part of it goes into what Stephen said. Like, I think that it's pretty unquestionable that the map that came after 2011 was not favorable to Democrats. And I think that's because of term limits. A lot of times people wait until a term is up. But I think also in some of these rural communities, You know, I've just heard this anecdotally. People don't want to run in races that are extremely competitive and that put kind of all their personal dealings on, kind of out there. Mm-hmm. And also the money aspect. Before this cycle, there was unlimited campaign contributions. Now they're capped, but just the expense it required to take over some of these seats is just probably too much for some people to handle. That's part of it. But there is also the change that some previously Democratic rural counties have become more Republican. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think that they're completely unsavable. I think places like Pike County, Monroe County, the Boot Heel, Saline County could probably have a resurrection of Democratic fortunes, but it's going to require a lot of work, and I think it's going to require candidates that are on the ground and have a lot of money and organization behind them. That's the challenge. Even when some instances where there were Democratic candidates in some of these rural seats, they often didn't really get well supported financially, and they pretty much lost by default.
Well, let's talk about money. I have 30 seconds left here, Stephen. There was a big push last year to wring political money out of the system. Voters passed this constitutional amendment that limits campaign donations, and million-dollar checks are history now. Did that work? Is the system now much freer of all that political money?
The system is certainly not free of corruption. Whether it's better or not remains to be seen. But one of the things that Eric Greitens campaigned on and has failed to deliver is true ethics reform in Jefferson City. Amendment 2 was a good place to start, but there needs to be closing a lot of loopholes, not letting caucuses take unlimited money, disclosing dark donors, all of these things that Eric Greitens campaigned on and is failing to deliver.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there. Jason Rosenbaum, who joined us from the studios of St. Louis Public Radio. Always appreciate it, Jason.
Thank you.
Stephen Weber, chairman of the Missouri Democratic Party. Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate
you bet.
It.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. On Monday's show, helping teens cope with increasing stress. It's an epidemic out there, folks, and we'll talk about it on Monday. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. He'll be joining us on Tuesday's show. We had help this week from Steven Steigman, Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.